Welcome to this edition of Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm the senior editor of American Theater. I'm joined today by...
Susie Evans. I'm the managing editor.
And my fellow senior editor...
Eliza Bent.
We're here to talk about a number of things. We're going to talk about a story Eliza wrote for our November issue, and then we're going to argue about a show that was at the Public, and then give our recommendations. So it's an all-in-house edition of Off Script this time. Eliza, your story in the November issue, you went in depth with young Gene Lee. It's a long-anticipated and long-overdue look at a great artist.
Yeah, totally.
That you've been following for quite a while.
Yeah. When I began working at TCG, young Gene Lee sat, like, on the other side of the divider. So... I've known her in that capacity, but then I've also been, I think the first show of hers that I ever saw was Songs of the Dragons Flying to Heaven in 2007. I'm not sure.
I think it's in your story
it's probably
somewhere.
Probably my story somewhere.
So tell me about going into this. This is really Straight White Men at the Public Theater, which opens November 7th, is in many ways sort of most high profile work, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she talks about how it's certainly the most mainstream venue that she's ever presented work at, so slash most funded, you know.
Right, and in a way, it's her most mainstream subject in a way, or sort of taking on the hegemony of the white male power structure or something to that effect. I don't know if she would define it that way.
I don't
know
if straight white men are more mainstream than other groups, Rob.
Well,
Rob Weinert-Kent is a straight white man, ladies and gentlemen.
I think
I hear the what's embedded in that. Yeah, certainly. It's the patriarchy is the subject.
Right, right. Tell me about some of the things you were most interested to find out going into the interview, and do you feel like you got...
Totally, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I've interviewed her a couple other times. For Church, I interviewed her, and I think I interviewed her about... Untitled Feminist Show. So we've had conversations in the past, but it's always interesting to me when an artist really hones down their like personal biography. I can totally see why people do that. They're asked these questions all the time, but I think she has a really unique story in the sense that she was studying to be an academic and playwriting was not on her radar, so to speak. Despite the fact that she was studying William Shakespeare, she did not have artistic ambitions of her own, and until it was sort of uncovered in a therapy session that she was having, because she was, as she says in the interview, very miserable. But so it was interesting to sort of hear that story, like, retold and sort of codified, in a sense, like, what that story is, and then, like, the kind of legend goes that she then went on to be in New Haven working on her dissertation after she had realized that she did, in fact, want to be a playwright and looked up who the best playwrights were at the, you know, Yale School of Drama and loved Jeff Jones's 70s.
Right, his was the weirdest stuff. So she sought him
his
out.
Was the, her, his play was the one that she responded to. And then he wrote her this like list, this like epic list of like names and places and venues. And from that list, it was like her map kind of. And then that's, it's like the Legend of Zelda. Like she had her her people to follow up with. And then sure enough, she worked with all those people. So
I was intrigued by the sort of contrast in her piece between then she went on to Brooklyn College and had, like, as she describes it, sort of an ideal mentor in Mack Wellman and the great peers that she worked with. But in the way she almost talks about herself as being having a charmed existence as a worker in the American theater, that she's always sought out what she describes as healthy, not dysfunctional relationships, and that in that sense she's always gravitated to that. And yet, paradoxically, what she wants to work on there is the stuff that's the least comfortable, the most grueling, awful things she can imagine doing. Like, that's her credo, right?
Right. The credo is sort of working on the last project that she wants to work on. The thing that she least wants to touch becomes the subject of her next piece.
Right.
So...
I mean, I was...
I think you probably have to have that balance, though, if you're working on something that's so uncomfortable or challenging and, like, the last thing in the world that you want to approach, whether that's, like, a solo show like her... We're Gonna Die, or deconstructing the identity politics of being African-American in this country.
Right.
You probably have to surround yourself with a really great team of people.
Otherwise,
you would just want to...
You don't want that to be grueling as well.
Exactly. And it sounds like she has a really great group.
No, I was intrigued that you went deep beyond that credo, because for me, I'm thinking at some point she must... While she's working on the piece, like what she's doing, like she might have undertaken these because they're the last thing she'd want to do. But at some point, she wants to do it, right?
Sure.
Right?
I don't know. I mean, she – not according to her.
No, right. According to her, she keeps it as hard as possible. She's hard on herself.
Yeah.
I guess the other question I have, maybe you could answer this. It's not explicitly addressed here, but is she going to run out of last things she wants to do? It's like there an endless list of things that she wants to resist.
That's a question you need to ask her, not me. But speaking on behalf of Youngjin Lee, yes, I will say no. I think there's no shortage of worst possible ideas. There's sort of some sexy marketing around that, right? Like
sure.
The worst idea possible or the last topic that you want to approach. But I think that especially considering her background as an academic, coming into this situation where she was getting her MFA at Brooklyn College, to have your playwriting professor tell you, just write the worst thing, just write the stupidest, dumbest thing, it's a really great mechanism to sort of switching your brain off or switching your inner critic off.
Right.
So I think using that adage is probably pretty helpful for her.
Is that something you as a writer ever use?
Oh, I'm not allowed to talk about my own personal writing on this. Ay, ay, ay.
But you also trained with Mac.
God forbid.
At Brooklyn College,
yes,
right?
Eliza? I went to Brooklyn College. I have an MFA in playwriting from there. I am a master playwright.
So you don't want to compare yourself to Youngjin Lee.
I wouldn't deign compare myself to a master of the form. I mean, she's at the top of her game.
Right.
Main stage show at the Public Theater.
I have a question.
Susie.
Since I'm not as familiar with Youngjin's work as Eliza is, but I did hear a lot about her solo show, We're Gonna Die. Does she perform in her other works? Is she often in her place?
No. The only other show that she sort of put herself into was Songs of the Dragons Flying to Heaven. And it was a really interesting... It's hard to even describe, but basically at the beginning of the show, she's is getting slapped in the face and talking with her collaborators about how she can be more hurt and better slapped. And it's a really unsettling video.
Oh, so she's in a pre-recorded bit of that.
Yeah, it was a pre-recorded, it wasn't live.
Another part of the interview that was really interesting to me in reading it and not being familiar with her work again was the idea that, and correct me if I'm wrong in assuming this, that Straight White Men was one of her first, like, straight plays, like in the sense that it's an actual like play, it's not taking any huge risks with the form.
It's not only about straight white men, it is also a straight play.
But she usually, from my understanding, just from hearing about her work, yes. She usually takes big dramatic risks and kind of, you know, plays with the form and sticks a fork in it and kind of pokes around. This feels more like
yes.
It was a struggle to her to play.
Now is not a time for puns. It is a straight play. It's her
naturalism.
It's a naturalistic. Yeah. Three-act, four-act mm-hmm. Play with naturalistic dialogue and relationships. Very followable narrative arc occurs. And, yeah, she's drawing on, like, you know, great American dramas.
Which for her feels experimental to do that.
Sure. Well, it's certainly different from a solo show about depression, right, that she's singing in We're Gonna Die. And it's certainly not, like, a reaction to King Lear. It's... Right. So no, that's a very
But
good
this
point.
Is really interesting to me in both in Rob's point in that this is her first like mainstream show at the well-funded public theater. I was just talking with Taylor Mack, whose play we're publishing in our December issue. His play Here, spelled H-I-R, is his first kind of straight play kitchen sink drama, and it's going to be produced by, I don't think I can announce it yet, but it's going to be produced by a big theater in New York City next season. And he's like,
I had to
write a straight theater play to get into the big institution. So I'm wondering if Youngjin felt like she had to write a straight theater play to get into an institution like the Public. Like, I know everyone loves Youngjin. I know you can answer that, but that's just a question I have.
No, I think that's interesting. And I mean, she talked about this when we spoke. And I don't know if it made it into these edits of the print version of the article. But she did mention, like, God, like, it's so scary to, like, you know, you start going to where the money is, right? And, like, I don't know what preceded what, like, if the Public made her an offer and then she proposed Straight White Men, or if it was how about we do Straight White Men at the Public. But yeah, I think that gets really tricky for an artist who's made a career of doing really provocative, interesting work.
For Taylor, it was the opposite. He had written the play and then the theater decided to produce it. And it was a theater he'd been trying to be produced in for 20 years and he had to write the straight play. So I'm really curious what came first, the funding or the work.
I don't know. I bet you anything that she probably had the idea first, but who knows? I'm not young Jean, so
would have. Well, I would almost think that, yeah, she would. It's almost like the match of idea, topic, and venue is all very young Jean. It feels like her play at the Public is going to be about this thing.
Well, I feel
a naturalistic play.
I could be making this up, but I have a strong memory of hearing her talk on a panel at one point, or somebody summarizing a point that she had made on some panel, talking about how always having the venue and the institution in mind for a particular project. That, like, you never just make a project and think, gee, where will this go? But you always think of a project as having an eventual home. And I think that's a pretty nifty idea.
But that's also, I don't want to use the word privilege necessarily, but that's, I'm going to use privilege, but it might be the wrong word, of a playwright like Young Jean Lee, who can approach the Public and, you know, have her work done and say, I have an idea for you. When you think of someone just writing a play, like Taylor Mack's not a good example because he also has a similar status of being well-known, but someone who might be more emerging, being like, I'm going to write this play for the Public, the Public's like, oh, ha, ha, ha.
Well, right, but when you're emerging, you're thinking about smaller venues probably. I mean, I don't know. That's advice that people can take or not take. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, well, I think she has emerged. She's not an emerging writer.
No. Oh, and I was not suggesting that.
I do think
mid-career.
It's interesting. She talks about just keeping her edge, basically, as she's been at it for as long as she is. And one way she does it is by taking on projects that put her nerves on edge, that make it hard.
Sure.
So,
but at the same time, a play like something called Straight White Men, a play about that at the Public, seems risky and experimental. Like, it seems like it's pushing boundaries.
Well, yeah, just the title. I mean, again, it feels very much like she's self-consciously writing a naturalistic play about that topic in a place where...
Yeah.
I mean, to give it some credit, it's not a place where only straight white men are on the stage, but it is, you know, it's the mainstream theater.
It's an institution. So it's institution. Like a long... Yeah, absolutely.
And it premiered somewhere else before the Public, right?
The Wexner Center.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact correct language is around it, but it had a showing at the Wexner Center.
Yeah, we wrote about it.
Ben Gaspin. Yeah, Ben Gaspin wrote a box about that. And
I think it had
productions in Austria.
There was a recent production
in Austria and at the Pompidou.
These were the out-of-town tryouts for straight white men, where this sort of circuit of...
They were probably honing their thing,
right. But those are like a circuit of theaters that will just do whatever Young Jean project is lined up. I mean, they would have done Untitled Feminist Show, those places. Whereas the Public, I don't know if they would have done Untitled Feminist Show.
I don't know what the Public would or wouldn't do.
Well, that's a good point.
I'm not them.
So it's a great piece. I highly recommend you read it in print or online. And we're about to, I think by the time this podcast is up, we will have the full extended transcript.
Online exclusive.
Of every word that Eliza and Young Jean said to each other, more or less.
Not a single word will be redacted. No like.
The grammar will be corrected, that's all. Speaking of the Public Theater, this is a very Public Theater focused episode. We wanted to talk now about a show that we all saw. That doesn't always happen. We often are off different tracks seeing different kinds of shows. The Public, as we talked about in one of our first podcasts, has a really extraordinary season this year. There's just on paper, you know, Lin-Manuel's show, Hamilton's coming up. Young Jean's is one of the much anticipated show that's running there currently. Fortress of Solitude, a musical based on the Jonathan Lethem novel we all happen to see. So I thought we'd kick off a discussion on this. This isn't a review show, but we're going to talk about what we thought of it, basically, right? I mean, I can start off just telling you a little bit about what the show is, and some of my opinion will probably bleed into that, and then we'll just throw it up for discussion. It's an adaptation of like a 500-page novel by Jonathan Lethem, which is about Brooklyn in the 70s and 80s, when he was coming of age himself, in a neighborhood, Gowanus, which is now called Borum Hill. I've been aware of this musical for many years. I interviewed Itamar Moses probably about 8 years ago and said, what else are you working on? I said, oh, this musical of Fortress of Solitude. And then Daniel Auchin, I've interviewed a couple times, and he was talking about it. It's been long in gestation, and Michael Friedman is the other partner. He's writing the music. So I was very nervous, even though I'd read the script and seen a rehearsal, about how it would work on stage. It's very hard to adapt. It's very episodic and a very introspective novel. I have to say, I was more or less blown away by the execution of it. I loved what they did with it. I knew I would like Michael Friedman's score, but I didn't know how they would tell the story as a piece of theater, because it's, again, it's a novel. There's a lot of interior content.
Well, should we say what the novel's about? The novel.
Yeah, it's about a boy growing up in Brooklyn in a neighborhood that's changing. That's where he's basically the only one of the only white kids in a mostly black neighborhood. Who has a lefty mom who thinks that the neighborhood should be integrated, and she abandons him early on. And he becomes best friends with his next-door neighbor, Mingus Rude, whose father is a sort of has-been soul singer. They grow up together and then drift apart, partly because of race and the neighborhood changes. And he later becomes a rock critic and tries to mend the bridges with the retired soul singer and with Mingus. The second act is strange, but I think it all... I was relieved and moved by the production.
Well,
in
I
equal
mean,
parts.
I saw an early preview. So again, as Rob mentioned, this isn't a review show, so this isn't necessarily a review. So I'm sure changes were made after I saw it. I too was really impressed with Michael Friedman's score. I think the score and the music is really, really brilliant. I think it's a career best for Friedman. What makes it really interesting, and what Rob mentioned, the Times piece that he wrote about the music, is that this character, Mingus Rude's father, is kind of a lapsed soul singer who was part of a group that had these songs that are reminiscent of, you know, real life bands. Rob probably knows better than I which bands they're reminiscent of, but Friedman has done a sort of songwriting style that's not necessarily pastiche, but
right. Recalls
songs you might be familiar with while also writing a musical theater score that, you know, has character-driven songs and songs for these two characters, these young boys. My issue with the show wasn't the score. I thought the score was brilliant, and I think that there's a number in the second act that's my favorite. I won't spoil it. It was how much time jumps between the first act and the second act. I felt like the structure was very difficult for me to grasp, having not read the novel. I had a lot of trouble following the story and following the characters. But I also feel like this is a show that is being divisive among people that see it. Some people really love it. Like Rob said, blown away. I had a friend who said it was on par with Rent. It's the best new musical she's seen since the 90s. And I'm someone who went to it and had a good time, really liked the music, thought it might have been a little long.
It's better than Rent.
It's better than Rent?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't think
but
it's
I don't
better
like
than
Rent,
Rent,
so go on.
It's very different than Rent. We shouldn't be comparing it to Rent.
Yeah.
It's a very different story, but it's weirdly structured. And yeah. I don't feel like we get into the boy's story until two-thirds of the way through the first act with a great superhero song, but which is a great song and a great number, but it takes a while to set us up and get there. And the mom character just keeps coming back, and I just kind of wanted her to go away after she left.
Oh, I couldn't get enough of her. Kristen C does a wonderful job.
She's
nobody
great.
Wears a wide-legged pant like her, and her hair was really good, too.
You're right about that.
I didn't have any problem with the actor. I thought the character was...
So that's your review? Kristen C, wide-legged pant.
Kristen C of the wide-legged pant.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's a tough look to pull off, and she did it with panache.
She did.
I don't know. I was surprised, actually, how much we got of the mother in the first act, because the mom disappears, so it is this sort of like...
Yeah.
At least in the book, she really disappears full on, and then...
She's very different in the book. Since you've read the book,
that's true.
The book, I found her sort of weirdly softened in the musical. In the book, she kicks that guy's ass.
That's right. I wanted her to...
You know? She beats up
the bully's ass.
The young bully, Robert Woolfolk, who's been harassing her son. She
comes back?
No, this is before she disappears. You know, it's a long novel, so she disappears maybe a third way into the novel.
Oh, even
very early
in like one-fifth, yeah.
But. So, Eliza, you seemed not to have liked it very much.
No, I wouldn't say that. I was commenting on was how much I enjoyed Kristen C's performance. I was not assessing the musical as a whole.
Right.
I am not a person of the musical theater, so
right.
It is always an interesting journey to take into the land of breakout songs and butt wiggles. But I loved, you know, I really enjoyed the, oh, my audience is laughing. I enjoyed the dance moves. I really liked the ensemble. I felt like we really saw the block. But I don't know. That's a really tough thing to adapt. And I hear both of your points about it being both a huge time leap, particularly if you're not familiar with the book already.
Right.
And also a really valiant addition to our great American theater landscape.
Yeah, I felt like it was flawed in the way only great works can be flawed. It had big flaws that are kind of, some of them are part of the novel, but I don't know. I just really was affected by it.
Being someone who hasn't read the novel, I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who had read the novel during intermission of the show, and he said something really was different in terms of the ring. They said they changed
the
ring.
Mm. Yeah,
were there
plot
any major
difference.
Changes in the musical that affected from
well,
the
Well, here's what's interesting is that, yeah, there's a lot of stuff not in it. Like we mentioned, Robert Woolfolk, the mother beats him up before she leaves. She's kind of softened in the musical, I think.
She's there all the time. Kristen C. gives a gorgeous performance,
right,
but the
right.
character is there all the time.
Well, I think they were trying to solve the issue of, like, her absence and her influence on his life and how much he blames or credits her for who he becomes. I will say the one criticism I think is fair. It's interesting, Eliza, you say that you felt the block. I feel like a lot of grit is missing from the novel.
Oh, it was very, like, IKEA.
Yeah.
It was an IKEA
or
block,
Sesame Street, we're saying.
Very,
people were
like,
saying.
Cheerful, like.
And the guy who plays Robert Woolfolk was a pretty cuddly bully. He was not someone that I really...
Oh, I loved him.
He's great. That guy, that actor was great. And he was especially good in the second act as Robert Woolfolk in prison and rapping.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. I don't think the prison is that much of a spoiler. But yeah, maybe it is. Some people go to prison in this show. We won't say anything more than that. Yeah,
Rob, why are you laughing?
The significance of the ring is definitely changed. But I will say I was worried about that and about changes to Rachel's character. The number that blew me away was that superhero number, because what they managed to do in that number is encapsulate and suggest a lot of things in the novel. There's a homoerotic part of the novel
totally.
Where the boys mess around with each other a little bit. They're not necessarily gay, although it's open to question.
I got that from
but
the
it's
show,
not.
Though.
But you get that. Well, you get that in, all in that number in which they magically pull together the superhero part, their bonding, a little bit of that homoerotic, but also drugs. The whole link between being high and flying is like not even really made explicit in the novel or suggested, but it's sort of like all worked. And that musical number where there's, and the song Superman, which has been from the show, it's like the first song you hear. That was where the show all came together, that one number. And it kind of the afterglow of that kept me going through
it's
the whole thing.
It's a great
number.
So. It's a really, really fantastic number. I'm not going to disagree with that. I also think the number in the prison, since we've let us know there's prison, is a great number in the second act.
It's a good one, yes.
That doesn't solve the divide between the timelines for me.
No. Well, and that is the flaw that is in the novel. The novel's sort of divided into two big sections with a little thing in the middle where the line
I wouldn't call that a flaw. I'd call that a bold move in the novel.
Well, I agree. It's a flaw, yeah.
But
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But for a musical, it certainly creates a difference.
Right.
But I'm
just
trying to wrap my mind around it. I don't think it's a flaw, and I think you can have that time-lapse musical. I mean, Act 1 ends with a very big moment that I won't spoil for you, and so it makes sense to have a...
Ends with a bang.
I'm just wondering if they could have approached it differently, solved it differently.
Right.
I'm just trying to think about why it bothered me so much, because musicals have time gaps all the time.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering why this one specifically was a gap for me.
It's a strange story, and I was just amazed how well they told it. Speaking of which, we can move on to the endorsement portion of the show, and I was just going to I'll start just because my endorsement is related to the musical. I just feel like lately, Fortune of Solitude included, I've seen like a number of musical theater or music theater productions where if they'd been selling a soundtrack at the door, I would have put down my cash to do it. To pay for it. Fortune of Solitude is one. Again, I knew I would love the music. I really love the score. The Last Ship, which is Sting's musical, it's not a great... you guys laugh.
No, I saw... If I may
interrupt
you.
Saw...
I was watching something on Netflix the other...
As we all do, yeah.
As one does in the late night. And I saw... I was like... What the heck is this? And it looked like an advertisement for something very oblique, and it was all these men that were like, oh, and like singing these like ship tunes.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
was like, I thought it was maybe a parody of something. I was like getting really excited for what parody like
right,
it was
right,
going
right.
to be. And then this like woman sort of like bosomed up to somebody, and,
uh-huh.
and she was like, la, and it was like, what is going on? And then it was like, the musical by Sting. That I was laughing because it was hilariously shot. But then I have heard nice things about it. You're the second person to enjoy it.
I can't answer for their advertising. I did not review, I'm not reviewing that.
I loved the ad. Don't get me wrong.
I will say it's not a great book. The score is, I think, a great score. And I feel like the book is good enough that the thing's going to be in the repertoire.
Are you endorsing cast albums? Is that what you're doing?
What I'm endorsing is theater music right now. I've got four scores in my head that are just were great. Last
four
ship,
scores and
four
seven
scores
heads
and
to go.
Last Ship, Fortress of Solitude, Ghost Quartet, which is an amazing show. Dave Malloy, Natasha Pierre, fame. It's a piece of theater, but it's a band. I just don't know anyone else who does what he does. I mean, Cesar Alvarez and the Lisps are the closest thing I can think of, but or what Gabriel Kahane does, frankly.
December issue.
Probably, and I would say it's a sign that you've seen a great musical when you're still humming the score weeks later without hearing it again, and that's On the Town. This production on Broadway is, I think, one of the best things I've ever seen on Broadway. It's like an MGM musical, one of those Singing in the Rain or Bandwagon, with the low comedy and the insanely overblown ballet dance dream sequences. I couldn't get enough of it. I'm definitely going to go back and see that.
What's it called again? On the Town?
On the Town. It's got an amazing score. Some of the stuff is like
a revival of a.
It's a revival of it's Leonard Bernstein, Adolf. It's
Green, Betty Comden. It's taken from the ballet from Jerome Robbins.
Right, Jerome Robbins.
New choreography.
But it's new choreography. It's just.
But then what did Sting do? Sting made new music.
Did I not say the name of it? The Last Ship? Did I not say The Last Ship?
Sorry. Yeah. You're talking about The Last Ship or On the Town?
I'm saying there are four musicals in my head.
I
haven't made this very clear, I guess. The Last Ship, Fortress of the Solitude, Ghost Quartet, and On the Town.
A new musical from Sting.
Gotcha. A new musical. And Dave Malloy.
Sting and Dave Malloy.
I would just say those four scores, the show's merits aside, you know, those four scores are ones I will cherish. And it's not often that I've seen that many great new musicals that I love. So, and I think I would consider Ghost Quartet as sort of a musical, you know?
I have something to endorse, but it's not really theater related. So
that's all right.
It might be faulty. I heard it endorsed on two other podcasts, and so I looked into it, and now I'm obsessed. It's a new podcast.
Okay.
It's called Serial.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's from, I think it's from This American Life.
Yeah.
Sarah Koenig is kind of the host. And it's amazing. I'm not really into Law and Order or CSI or any of those or any, like, true crime novels. It's not really my thing. It's kind of this, like, true crime story told in these episodes. And it's genius. I'm so addicted.
So did he do it or didn't he?
I don't know. She leaves you with a cliffhanger every episode.
Right.
But if we're doing more theater, do you want me to?
How far along is it?
There are six episodes. They kind of vary in length from an hour to like 20 minutes. It's totally great. It's like the old days of radio. Like you just want to sit and listen to it.
It's the
greatest story. So I kind of see it as like storytelling, drama, radio.
Sure. Totally. It's theater of the air.
It's totally worth checking out. It's called Serial. And if I need to be more theater explicit, I adored Found at Atlantic Theater Company. Just thought it was tons of fun. So go see that.
Another new musical.
It's by Hunter Bell, and it's adapted from Found Magazine, and they kind of adapted it with this group called the Story Pirates, which does improv and kind of storytelling with kids. They have kids write notes and letters and create scenes based on the kids' writing. And so they've done this musical called Found, which is based on Found Magazine. The narrative of it is kind of thin. It's about, you know, these three kids in their 20s who start a magazine and do really well, and romance and life comes to the end. They get split up, and they come together, and kind of the storyline is, but what they've done amazingly is they've taken these notes. Found Magazine is a magazine that publishes notes that people find. So, like, they weren't addressed to those people. They've taken these notes and they've kind of make them the inner monologue of the characters at certain points. So, like, if Eliza and I are having a conversation, I'm thinking something that I'm not saying, a third-party ensemble member will come on and, like, say a note that has nothing related to it, but might be like, I hate you, Joe, or like some weird note that somebody found, but an ensemble will speak the inner monologue. And the way they've staged it is so interesting. And then they've also created these hilarious songs kind of based on these notes. There's an epic number in the middle where they read this note about how this class has been expelled from the theater because they don't want to repeat what happened at the Johnny Tremaine. And they're like, what happened at Johnny Tremaine? And then they have this fantasy sequence about this kid that probably interrupted the whole audience at Johnny Tremaine. So they're staging Johnny Tremaine on stage. And there's actors running up the aisles in the audience pretending to be the kids in the audience. So you, like, hear people talking in the audience. And, like, actors on stage start yelling. It's really epic if you go to the theater a lot. And I just feel like they've done it really creatively. And it's tons of laughs. And I had tons of fun. I haven't had that much fun in the theater in a while. So it was fun.
But would you buy the score if they were selling it?
I don't know if I would buy the score, but I would definitely go see it again.
Ah.
Danny Pudi from
Go
Community
See It Again
is,
is a huge endorsement.
I guess it is, yeah. For theater, but for music. No, but I'm
well,
just kidding.
I mean, there's some funny songs, but I feel like what makes the songs funny is the performances. I mean,
right.
There's some great The whole ensemble's great. Nick Blamire is the lead. Barrett Wilbert Weed, who got a lot of awards buzz for when she was starring in Heather's the Musical, is the main girl.
Oh, she's great. I love
Molly
her.
Molly Pope is in the ensemble, fixture of Downtown Cabaret. Fantastic. Danny Pudi from Community. You know, Abed, I think is his name on that show. He's in it. So great. Everyone just kind of embraces their individuality, and it's a hilarious, fun time at the theater. Go see it.
Well, speaking of Downtown Cabaret genius, a song that has been stuck in my head has been Rock Bottom, Hey Rock Bottom by the inimitable Bridget Everett at Joe's Pub. Speaking, this is the all public issue of this podcast. But no, Bridget Everett, her show might be called Rock Bottom, but she is at the top of her form in a truly miraculous
She's
evening.
A genius. Yeah, I saw her show.
Really epic.
It's amazing. Go amazing. Into the YouTube spiral.
Did you anything happen the night you were there that you can tell us about?
So
that
many
was untoward?
Things happened. Okay. I don't know. I was laughing so hard I could barely keep track.
All Andre right. DeShields licked her inner thigh at my performance.
Oh, my God. There was a lot of salacious and salubrious behavior.
Nice.
It was great. She's awesome.
So, all public all the time. We promise future editions will talk about theaters outside New York.
And Dave Malloy's On the Town.
Yes, there's those.
Is Ghost Quartet still running?
Yeah.
It is? Okay. Someone told me it closed.
Speaking
over
of songs that have in the head, I had Wind and Rain in my head the other day.
Nice.
On a day that was windy and rainy. that sticks with you.
Would you happen to know how long Ghost Quartet is running?
It closes on Saturday.
Okay, so this podcast will be out by before then. On that note, thank you for listening to this edition of Off Script. It was great to have you, Eliza, Susie.
Oh, love to be here.
And our engineer, Deep. Thank you very much for listening, and tune in next time.
American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. Visit us online at www.americantheater.org.